Go ahead and open your Bibles to Ezra chapter number 10. We know that the scribe priest Ezra came to Jerusalem in the fifth month of the Jewish year, 457 BC as we know it. So he arrived in the summertime, and within a couple of months, once the end of summer came and the 137th sabbatical year ended, he ordered that the walls of Jerusalem start being rebuilt. And that, as I've told you a couple of times now, kicks off the timer that we see for the Messiah in Daniel chapter number 9. But then a couple of more months after that, in the ninth month of the Jewish year, so now we're talking about getting into the winter almost of that year, December, he is told that a bunch of the exiles that have returned over the past 75 years have married non-believers. That is, they have married non-Jews who worship other gods and goddesses, and that was not supposed to be happening. And so we see that Ezra immediately began to grieve. He began to confess to God that this was not right, that this was really a bad choice on their behalf. And he is in the temple crying and grieving over this in front of the people. And that's where we want to pick up our story today. Chapter number 10, verse number 1. While Ezra prayed and made confession, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, a very great assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him out of Israel, for the people wept bitterly. So the word starts to get out there at Jerusalem that the leader, Ezra, is at the temple complex. He's ripped his clothing in grief, and he is crying out and confessing and throwing himself down in front of God's house. Now, he's not up at the building itself, probably. He's probably in the forecourt. And so when they hear that this is what's happening, they start showing up there and they begin to be of the same mindset. So this is a good example of good leadership. The broken heart of Ezra leads the people's heart to break. Verse number 2. Shechaniah, the son of Yahiel, of the sons of Elam, addressed Ezra. We have broken faith with our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. But even now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. So here comes one of the guys, apparently, that had been involved in this. And until Ezra got upset about it, he apparently didn't realize that it was such a bad idea. But now he's acknowledged that, yes, this is not what we should have done, but certainly there's still hope. And he gives a suggestion, verse 3, therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all these wives and their children according to the counsel of my Lord and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Now, what he suggests is a very extreme sort of project. He is actually recommending mass divorces and also arrangements for the care of the children in those divorce proceedings. And this is why it's going to take a long time to sort this out. Now, this might come as a surprise for many people who know that God does not like divorce, that God would demand divorce in these circumstances. And it's all because of the threat to faith that this situation represents. It is the way that it's already happened in the past several times, that the Jewish people lose their devotion to God by marrying those who have no such devotion and who eventually turn the heart of the person toward those other gods and goddesses. Solomon is the prime example of this. He married many foreign women who worshipped other gods and goddesses, and eventually he started worshiping those gods and goddesses, and he lost his relationship with God. So this man, Shechaniah, is saying, all right, I think the solution is obvious. There has to be some mass divorces. And verse number 4. Arise, for it is your task, and we are with you. Be strong and do it. So he says, you're the guy to take care of this the proper way, Ezra. You need to give us proper leading. So Ezra arose and made the leading priests and Levites and all Israel take oath that they would do as had been said. So they took the oath. So the oath here is, we will do according to the law of God as you, Ezra, direct us. Because remember, Ezra is a scribe priest. He is well skilled in the law. And so they trust him to help untangle this mess that they've gotten themselves into. Verse number 6. Then Ezra withdrew from before the house of God and went to the chamber of Yohanan, the son of Eliashib, where he spent the night. So this is probably in the larger Temple Mount area. Neither eating bread nor drinking water, for he was mourning over the faithlessness of the exiles. So he continues his fast, and it is especially an especially severe fast because he's not even drinking water. He doesn't plan to go on for a long time like this, but he is showing that nothing is as important as getting this situation taken care of. Verse 7. And a proclamation was made throughout Judah and Jerusalem to all the returned exiles that they should assemble at Jerusalem. So there is an emergency assembly order that goes out. Now, every year, three times a year, all adult men, so basically the heads of households, have to come to Jerusalem for Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. So they're already used to mandatory assemblies of that sort. So this is a super assembly that's needed to take care of this issue. But it has to have some teeth attached to it. Verse 8, and that if anyone did not come within 3 days by order of the officials and the elders, all his property should be forfeited, and he himself banned from the congregation of the exiles. This is how serious it is. If you do not show up at Jerusalem for this emergency meeting, you will be kicked out of Israel and your property confiscated, because you have to be part of the covenant in order to receive the inheritance of the land. So this is very, very serious. Verse number 9. Then all the men of Judah and Benjamin assembled at Jerusalem within the 3 days. Now Judah and Benjamin were the two major tribes of the kingdom of southern Judah. Simeon also had bits and pieces into that. But they were the two major tribes for the southern kingdom of Judah that went into exile. And so often, they are mentioned in association with the restored Judea area. So all of the people living basically in the tribal region of Benjamin, which would be to the north of Jerusalem, all the way down into the Jordan Valley near Jericho, and then off to toward the plain to the west. And then all of the area around Jerusalem and south of Jerusalem, down into the Negev, the southern hills, probably inclusive of places like Hebron, Bethlehem. That tribal region right there is where the province of Judah is located right now. And this is where all of these returnees have settled, in that area. It's a day's walk from even the farthest portion of that. So 3 days was more than sufficient time for them to show up. So all of the men of Judah and Benjamin assembled at Jerusalem within the 3 days. It was the ninth month on the 20th day of the month. So now we find out that Ezra first heard this information on the 18th day of the ninth month of this year of return. And so that renders a date. Let me make sure my notes are here in front of me. That renders a date on our calendar something like the 7th of December, 457 BC. And so 3 days later brings us to the 9th of December, 457 BC. All the people sat in the open square before the house of God. So the temple had a forecourt area where the water tank was located for all the ceremonial washing, and then the sacrificial altar. And then there was a worship area in front of that off to the east. So on the Temple Mount, to the eastern side of it, that's where these guys are gathering, in a great big open area. And it says they were trembling because of this matter. So they're very upset. They're anxious about how this is going to be resolved. And because of the heavy rain. As I already told you, this is the beginning of December. It is the wet weather season. And so it is raining on this particular day. And it is chilly at this particular time of year. It's not snowing because it's raining, obviously. It's not cold enough to snow. And so everybody is wet and upset. Verse number 10. Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, so here's his address, "You have broken faith and married foreign women, and so increased the guilt of Israel. Now therefore, make confession to He who is the God of your fathers and do His will. Separate yourself from the peoples of the land and from the foreign wives." Straight to the point. You've sinned by breaking the law that said you are not supposed to marry non-Israelis that worshiped other gods and goddesses. And because of that, you are threatening to bring God's judgment down upon us as a nation. The only resolution is for you to reverse your choices, repent, and change. And so their response is this, verse 12. All the assembly answered with a loud voice, "It is so." So that's the confession. We did the crime. We must do as you have said. So we will be involved in the mass divorces. But, verse 13, the people are many, and it is a time of heavy rain. We cannot stand in the open, nor is this a task for one day or even for two, for we have greatly transgressed in this matter. So the people's response, this is kind of the representatives talking back to Ezra. They say, there's too many of us that have engaged in this. to untangle it in a day or two. And it's nasty weather. We can't all just hang around out here for the weeks that it's going to take in order this to get fully resolved. So we need to make appointments to get this taken care of. Verse number 14. Let our officials stand for the whole assembly. Let all in our cities who have taken foreign wives come at appointed times, that is, on a schedule, and with them the elders and the judges of every city, until the fierce wrath of our God over this matter is turned away from us. Now, at this point, I want to let you know, or remind you, that the sin is not simply marrying a non-Israeli. It's not a matter of flesh. It's not a matter of ethnicity. The problem is that the majority of those who are not Israelis worship other gods and goddesses. So marrying them has brought ethnic Israelis that are supposed to be devoted only to the worship of God into intimate contact with those who worship other gods and goddesses. So the divorces are going to be targeted against those who have married husbands or wives that worship other gods and goddesses. Now, we can already know, without any type of fear of being wrong, that at least some of the Israelis have married proselytes, men and women who have abandoned the worship of other gods and goddesses and embraced the worship of the one true living God. People such as Rahab and people like Ruth. Those are two good examples in the family tree of Jesus of women who left their pagan backgrounds, married into the Israeli family, and that was perfectly legitimate. So it's not the ethnicity that's the problem. It's the religion. So all the divorces are going to be divorces between Jewish people that are married to people that worship other gods and goddesses. And then there's going to have to be the resolution of what happens with the kids. Now, parental rights are going to be in debate here. And this is problematic. And those of you that have blown off the instruction of Scripture and you were unequally yoked to someone, you married a non-believer, or possibly you were an unbeliever already when you were married and then you converted, you know that the problem often in a family like that is the kids. Who's going to instill their faith system into the children? Now, some families have come up with this idea, well, one weekend they'll go with me to my worship service, and then next week they'll go to your worship service. That's not a good resolution for the kids' sake. We need probably to see in what's happening here that the leadership of Israel wants to make sure that the children in these divorced situations still get some sort of instruction about the true and living God so that they will make a choice to embrace Him as their God. And so that's why it's going to take so long, is because each case has to be judged on its merits, so that if the people have already converted, that's acceptable. If they're willing to convert, well, then there's going to have to be some guarantees that it's not just fate. If they refuse to convert, then there has to be arrangements made for any children that are involved in the circumstance and situation. So that's why it's going to take weeks for this to be dealt with. Now, verse 15, only Jonathan, the son of Asahel, and Jahaziah, the son of Tikvah, opposed this. So apparently they were either all in, everybody is just automatically divorced, or they were all opposed. There's no reason for this. I don't know which one it was, but these two guys, they don't want to do the appointment system. And Meshulam and Shabbatai, the Levites, supported them. So there's another two guys that are not in with the solution, but it doesn't matter because Ezra has already said this is the way it's going to be. Verse 16, then the returned exiles did so. Ezra the priest selected men, heads of fathers' houses, according to their fathers' houses, each of them designated by name. On the first day of the 10th month, they sat down to examine the matter. So about 10 days into the future, that's when the first appointments start happening. So 18th of December, we'll call it something like that on our calendar. But it was the first day of the 10th month. So that's when the appointments start. And verse 17, by the first day of the first month, they had come to the end of all the men who had married foreign women. So it takes them effectively 2 whole months for all the appointments to resolve the circumstance and situation. Now, the text here mentions specifically men who have married foreign women, but there would most certainly have been a few appointments that would be about women, Israeli women who had married paganized men who worshipped other gods and goddesses, because that resolution would have needed to be fixed as well. Starting at verse number 18, we start listing all the names of the people. Verse 18, now there were some found of the sons of the priests who had married foreign women, and then names off their names. Verse 19, they pledged themselves to put away their wives, and their guilt offering was a ram of the flock for their guilt. And then it's got the names again of all those that were involved in this. So it's not just simply having it investigated and then going through the proceedings to end the marriage, if that was the appropriate way to deal with it, but they also had to go through ceremony of forgiveness. They had to give the proper sacrifices in order to get things back on track. And so the rest of the book is all about those names. Verse 44 says, all these had married foreign women, and some of the women had even born children. And of course, deciding who is going to be overseeing the religious instruction of any minor children would have been part of the resolution or part of the appointment schedule that would have been taken care of. At this point, we're going to take a little break from the history porch and go to a psalm, Psalm 102. And this is a psalm that may have been written sometime around this time. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Let my cry come to you. Don't hide your face from me in the day of my distress. Incline your ear to me. Answer me speedily in the day when I call. So the person is asking for God to respond. For my days pass away like smoke. My bones burn like a furnace. My heart is struck down like grass and has withered. I forget my bread. Because of my loud groanings, my bones cling to my flesh. Meaning they're fasting so long that they're losing weight. I am like a desert owl in the wilderness, like an owl of the waste places, moaning probably. I lie awake. I'm like a lonely sparrow in the housetop. All the day my enemies taunt me. Those who deride me use my name for a curse. For I eat ashes like bread and mingle tears with my drink because of your indignation and anger. For you have taken me up and thrown me down. My days are like an evening shadow, and I wither away like grass. one of the reasons I put this here is because the people of Israel during Ezra's time would have been brokenhearted over all of this. Verse 12, but you, O he who is, are enthroned forever. You are remembered throughout all generations. You will arise and have pity on Zion, a poetic name for Jerusalem. It is the time to favor her. The appointed time has come. For your servants hold her stones dear and have pity on her dust. Nations will fear the name of he who is, and all the kings of the earth will fear your glory. For he who is builds up Zion. He appears in his glory. He regards the prayer of the destitute and does not despise their prayer. So talk here about rebuilding Jerusalem. Let this be recorded for a generation to come, so that a people yet to be created may praise he who is, that he looked down from his holy height, from heaven, he who has looked at the earth to hear the groans of the prisoners, to set free those who were doomed to die, that they may declare in Zion the name of he who is, and in Jerusalem his praise, when peoples gather together and kingdoms to worship he who is. So you can tell this is kind of a psalm of the return. He has broken my strength in mid-course. He shortened my days. That'd be judgment. Oh, my God, I say, take me not away in the midst of my days, you whose years endure throughout all generations. So don't cut my life short in judgment. Of you, of old, you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will remain. They'll wear out like a garment. You will change them like a robe, and they will pass away. But you are the same, and your years have no end. The children of your servants shall dwell secure. Their offspring shall be established before you. So we end with this reminder. Everything in this life is temporary, including us. But God is forever.